Okay, welcome. This will be the 85th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1, a transitional year resident, that's ultimately going into radiology. So in today's podcast, I'm going to be finishing up a discussion of HemOnc for the USMLE Step 1. So this will be part 6, and this will be the final part. So we'll be done with, we can finally close the chapter on HemOnc. So really, today's purpose is just to clean up certain things I haven't talked about. This should hopefully not be a long podcast, right? And the first topic I'll start with, right? What if you get a question about a person that's Northern European ancestry, and then they give you like a history of like anemia in dad, grandma, grandmom, whatever, like basically a genetic history. If you see that, you really want to think about a hereditary spherocytosis. Classically on exams, right, they will tell you the person is from like a Northern European country. And remember, the reason you're seeing that genetic history is that it's actually inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? And basically, the mechanism behind hereditary spherocytosis is that you have mutations in certain proteins that constitute the cytoskeleton of red blood cells, right? And to be honest with you, you actually do want to know the names of these proteins, right? So there's proteins like spectrin. There's another one known as ankyrin. There's another one known as band 3, okay? There's one that's lower yield, they call it like protein 4.2, but that's beside the point. But band 3, you definitely want to remember. You may say, Divine, I've never seen that show up on an exam. Think again, okay? Think again. So, band 3, spectrin, and ankyrin, those are like the big ones you definitely want to know, right? So, how do you make the diagnosis of hereditary spherocytosis? I mean, obviously, right, if you look under the microscope, right, for these spherocytes, they're basically like red blood cells that lack central pallor, and they're very tiny, right, because it's like, because they have all these like membrane protein defects, you essentially have a fixed amount of hemoglobin that's crumpled into a smaller space, right? So if you expose that spherocyte to a hypotonic solution, right, that cell will explode, right? Because in the presence of a hypotonic solution, water will flow into the red blood cell and that cell will explode. That's what's actually known as the osmotic fragility test. That's one test that can be used for the diagnosis of hereditary spherocytosis. Another somewhat similar test is called the acidified glycerol lysis test. You basically add acidified glycerol to like a hypotonic solution containing the spherocytes, and again, that will cause an abnormally elevated amount of hemolysis, right? It's kind of similar to the osmotic fragility test. And then remember that band 3 protein I talked about? There is actually a protein, there is like a fluorescent protein that has the ability to bind band 3. Okay, that protein is actually known as eosin 5 maleimide. So that's actually what constitutes the eosin 5 maleimide screening test for hereditary spherocytosis. And I mean, obviously, if you do red blood cell studies, right? The classic thing, remember I talked about it in the podcast actually, I believe from yesterday. I said that your MCHC is increased in the setting of hereditary spherocytosis. That's a big, big thing you want to know, right? And really the way you treat this, because for the most part, the spherocytes are not a huge issue. The problem is they get trapped in the spleen and the spleen destroys them. So if you actually do a splenectomy, you can actually go ahead and treat hereditary spherocytosis that way. But remember, before you take out that spleen, you want to vaccinate against Shin organisms, right? So like strep pneumo, H flu, and Neisseria, because remember, your spleen helps you protects you against encapsulated bugs, right? And really, these patients with hereditary spherocytosis, because they're having all this hemolysis, right? And they're forming all this bilirubin, right? They're actually at very high risk of like gallstones, right? So like cholelithiasis, usually like the pigmented kind. So, I think that's all I'm going to say about a hereditary spherocytosis. Again, it's a high yield disorder to know, shows up on all the USMLEs, super, super high yield to know. So, I guess, and I mean, one thing I guess I can go ahead and mention is that hereditary spherocytosis, it's usually a kind of hemolytic anemia that's Coombs negative. I'll talk about the Coombs test in a bit. It's just one of those weird, bizarre things you want to know. I'll sort of talk about the mechanism in a short while, right? In fact, you know what? Let me go ahead and talk about the Coombs test now, because it's kind of important to know, right? So the thing is, there are two kinds of Coombs tests, right? So there's the direct Coombs and there's the indirect Coombs. Now, there are two things I think are most important to know with the Coombs tests. The first thing that's important to know is you want to know the mechanism behind each Coombs test, and then you want to know the indications for each Coombs test, right? So there's a direct and indirect. Let's talk about the direct first. So for a direct Coombs test, the thing you try to do, right, the indication for a direct Coombs test is basically to test for the hemolytic anemias, okay? You test for the hemolytic anemias with a direct Coombs test. Now, for the indirect Coombs test, you use it to basically screen a patient's blood for antibodies before using that patient's blood in a transfusion process, right? So let's talk about the direct Coombs test. I said you use it to screen for the immune-mediated hemolytic anemias, right? So basically, let's think about this for a second. The direct Coombs test, if a person has like a hemolytic anemia, the thing that happens is that their red blood cells are coated with antibodies, okay? That's, and it can, the antibodies can be IgG, that would be like the warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia, or IgM in the setting of the cold autoimmune hemolytic anemia, right? So if your red blood cells are already coated with antibodies, the thing you can do is you can basically have a solution that includes those red blood cells that are already coated with the bad antibodies, and then you add antiglobulin, right? That antiglobulin is known as Coombs reagent. If you have aberrant antibodies on the surfaces of red blood cells, then you will have agglutination of those red blood cells, and that's a positive direct Coombs test, okay? That's a test for autoimmune hemolytic anemias. Remember, your autoimmune hemolytic anemias, like I said, there's those that are IgG mediated, right? Those are the warm autoimmune hemolytic anemias. And I mean, those can be caused by many things, right? They can be caused by, you can observe those in the setting of lupus, right? Remember, lupus can have like autoimmune anemias as a, like a sequelae of a lupus. Another classic exam presentation is with certain drugs, right? So like alpha-methyl-DOPA, remember, it's that drug that's associated with drug-induced lupus, right? So you see that lupus association again. It's associated with drug-induced lupus, but it also is very good for the treatment of hypertension in pregnancy. It's a large molecule, so it doesn't cross the placenta as well, okay? So it's one of those antihypertensives that are safe in pregnancy. Alpha-methyl-DOPA, very good for the treatment of hypertension in pregnancy, but it's associated with autoimmune hemolytic anemias, especially the warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia. Another classic drug that's associated is like your cell wall synthesis inhibitors, right? So like your beta-lactams, like your penicillins, your cephalosporins also have that association, right? So again, autoimmune hemolytic anemias, the warm kind, the IgG-mediated type, think about those in the context of drugs, okay, and also lupus. Now, the cold autoimmune hemolytic anemia, that's usually associated more with like IgM, okay? And usually those patients will present with like Raynaud's phenomenon on an MBME exam, right? And the thing is, there are certain bugs that actually have that association with that IgM-mediated cold autoimmune hemolytic anemia. Classically, it's like mycoplasma, okay? I remember mycoplasma is the thing that causes like atypical pneumonia. In fact, it's very high yield to know this. Mycoplasma pneumoniae is the most common cause, very high yield. It's the most common cause of atypical or walking pneumonia. Right, so if you see like interstitial infiltrates on imaging in a patient that's not immunocompromised, especially in a person that's between the ages of 20 to 40, you really want to think about mycoplasma pneumonia, and it's associated with the IgM or cold autoimmune hemolytic anemia. I mean, the Epstein-Barr virus also has like a weak association, but I really want you to think more about mycoplasma pneumonia. Right, so this represents an example of a disease condition that has a bug association. Right, so I guess think of it as like a hematologic disease that has a bug association, right? So if you remember, I talked about a porphyria cutanea tarda in the podcast from either yesterday or this morning. And porphyria cutanea tarda has an association with Hep C, okay? But cold autoimmune hemolytic anemia has an association with EBV and mycoplasma. Mycoplasma is the stronger association. And again, you will test for these diseases with the direct Coombs test. Okay, now the indirect Coombs test, I said you use it to screen blood to see if it contains a nasty antibodies, right, that may react against a person's blood, that basically against the person that you're giving a transfusion, right? So take for example, if you're giving, let's say you have person let's say you have person A, okay, person A needs blood, okay, And person B is the donor. So keep it straight. You can probably write this down. Person A needs blood, gonna get transfusion. Person B is the person donating the blood. The thing is, you want to make sure that person A's blood does not contain antibodies that would react against the blood he's getting from the donor, person B. Okay, so the way you test for the presence of antibodies in person A's serum is with the indirect Coombs test, right? So I give you an example, right? So in fact, let me just sort of walk through it, right? So the thing that happens is the person that's receiving the blood, right, person A, you go ahead and pull out their red blood cells from the plasma, right? Because all you care about is, do they have antibodies that can react against the blood they are going to receive from this donor, right? So you are actually not testing their red blood cells. You are actually testing you're actually testing their serum for the presence of bad antibodies, right? So you strip off the red blood cells of the person receiving the blood, right? So the recipient of the blood transfusion, and then you take their serum, okay? And when you take their serum, you mix it with a small portion of the blood that they're about to receive, okay? And then after you do that mix, you then add the antiglobulin. Okay, like the Coombs reagent. And if you have agglutination, then that tells you that you are dealing with, that tells you that, oh, okay, this person that is receiving the blood transfusion, person A, so the recipient of the blood transfusion, has antibodies that will have a bad reaction against the blood they are receiving from the donor. That's person B. Okay, so again, high yield to, I know it's subtle, but it's actually super, 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 super high yield to know this. In a direct Coombs test, you are checking for antibodies that are already bound to the red blood cell membranes, okay? And you use that in the setting of autoimmune hemolytic anemias to test for those autoimmune hemolytic anemias. Contrast that with the indirect Coombs test, okay, that is used, that essentially detects antibodies that are not bound to red blood cells, but antibodies that have the potential to bind to red blood cell membranes. You find them more in the serum. Okay, that's why it's called an indirect Coombs test, and that's why you have that mixing procedure that happens before the test occurs. Okay, again, subtle. If you need to rewind this to listen to it, I will highly encourage you to listen to this. It's just one of those things I can almost promise you'll see on step one, you'll see on some shelf exams during your third year, and you'll also see on step two as well. Okay, and also potentially on step three. Very high yields to understand this. So now that we're done with the Coombs test, right, we can, I guess, talk about like some classic patterns of hemolysis, right? So you can see people having some, you've heard me refer to this in prior hematology podcasts where I talk about like intravascular hemolysis and extravascular hemolysis, right? The thing is, extravascular hemolysis is something that occurs basically like in the spleen, in the bone marrow, and in the can also occur in the liver, right? Basically, macrophages, they gobble up red blood cells, and then when they gobble up those red blood cells, they basically explode them. And when you explode those red blood cells, then the person gets an unconjugated hyperbilirubinemia, and then goes through that whole process that I believe I already described in my biochemistry video. So, extravascular hemolysis, something that happens in the spleen, is actually a lot more common than intravascular hemolysis, okay? And the key thing, again, you want to know is that it occurs from macrophages that are in the reticular endothelial system, like the spleen, like the liver, like the bone marrow, okay? Now, contrast that with intravascular hemolysis that is actually less common, but certainly still happens, okay? Intravascular hemolysis literally occurs intravascularly. It occurs inside the bloodstream. Okay, and usually the certain things that can cause intravascular hemolysis are things like paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. That's a relatively common cause of intravascular hemolysis. Although I'll say that in general, intravascular and intravascular hemolysis tend to occur together. Okay, but a pathognomonic finding in the setting of intravascular hemolysis is something known as is a phenomenon where your haptoglobin is severely decreased, right? So if they give you an exam question and a person has like red urine from like hemoglobinuria and whatnot, and they tell you that their haptoglobin levels are super low, you really, 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 really want to think about an intravascular hemolysis that is arising in the setting of like some kind of hemolytic process, like paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. So I'm trying to think, is there any other thing I really want to say about this? Oh, actually, I do. There are some other high yield things I want to say, right? So I said that intravascular hemolysis, PNH is a classic example. DIC, so disseminated intravascular coagulation, is another classic MBMA exam cause of intravascular hemolysis, right? So remember, in DIC, you observe schistocytes. In fact, if you see schistocytes in an MBME question, that should lead you more towards intravascular hemolysis versus extravascular hemolysis. So schistocytes and a decrease or an undetectable haptoglobin, that tells you that you're dealing more with intravascular hemolysis. Okay, and usually those people tend to have like red urine, and their kidneys also kind of look red, right? Because again, all that hemoglobin that's like spilled into the circulation just basically goes to the kidneys and is gotten rid of through your renal system. And I think that's all I really want to say about intravascular versus extravascular hemolysis. Again, that haptoglobin relationship and the schistocytes that you find in intravascular hemolysis, that's probably like a very useful delineating factor between those two. But extravascular hemolysis, for the most part, is a lot more common than intravascular hemolysis. And I mean, I've been talking about intravascular hemolysis and talking about PNH, paroxysmal and nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Again, I sort of kind of talked about this earlier on. I believe I talked about this either yesterday, in yesterday's podcast, or the podcast I made this morning. But basically, PNH, right? It's not a great disease, but the classic way it will present in a young person, okay, that is having like weird thrombotic episodes, right? So they can have like thrombosis of like a mesenteric artery, or a thrombosis of like they just basically have like they can have like hepatic artery thrombosis, like really weird thrombosis, and then they also have like red urine, and then they have a hemolytic anemia. If you see that triad, you really want to think about paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Right. And the thing is, it basically arises when a person has like a pig A mutation. I mean, if you sort of scramble the words pig A, you can get out the word GPI anchor. Okay. So you have like a pig A gene mutation. When you have a pig A gene mutation, you essentially lose the gene that helps you produce certain like sticks. So like certain proteins that help you hoist things like CD55. I believe CD55 is known as decay accelerating factor, and CD59 that essentially protects your red blood cells from hemolysis, right? So I mean, CD55, I would hopefully in the future have an immunology podcast, but the thing is, CD55 essentially prevents like C3 convertase from forming, and if you do not form C3 convertase, right, then you would not lyse your red blood cells. But if you're obviously lacking CD55, then C3 fragments will sort of build up on the surfaces of your red blood cells, and then through like the alternative or complement cascade, they will lyse your red blood cells under those circumstances. CD59, right, it's like the thing that, if you remember from eculizumab that I talked about in this morning's podcast, with like Neisseria sepsis, you need C5 through C9 to form the membrane attack complex. And the thing is, everyone needs to be present for that membrane attack complex to happen, right? So the thing that occurs is that CD59, its normal job is to bind to C9 and prevent it from associating with C5 through C8. So you end up not forming that membrane attack complex, right? So if you're lacking CD59, you have C9 binding to its C5 through C8 buddies, and then you'll run into trouble relatively quickly with the membrane attack complex that essentially explodes your red blood cells. Okay, so those are the two mechanisms behind the hemolysis that are observed in paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Okay, so how do you test for PNH? Really, the way you test for it is you can do something called an old test that you may still see on the USMLEs. It's called like the HAM test. Sometimes people call it the in fact, let me not complicate things too much. It's called the HAM test. You basically acidify a solution and you notice that the person's red blood cells explode at a higher than normal rate than a normal like control or red blood cells. If you see that, you're thinking about PNH, right? And the reasoning behind that is actually acidity increases the propensity of complement to lyse cells that it is bound to. In fact, one of the proposed mechanisms behind the red urine that's found in the presence of PNH, one probably that's more correct is that, when you get up in the morning, your urine is more concentrated, so you see like your urine appears like red. But another thing people think about is that if you really think about it, right, when you sleep, right, you don't breathe as fast as when you're awake, right? So you're essentially hypoventilating when you sleep. When you hyperventilate, you retain CO2. When you retain CO2, you get a respiratory acidosis. So that acidosis, right, can trigger more complement-mediated lysis of your red blood cells. So you observe more hemoglobinuria in the mornings. Okay, so the person's urine just looks very red in the morning. So that's a potential mechanism behind the red urine that's observed in the setting of PNH. So you can use that HAMS test to diagnose a PNH. But really, the method that's essentially used by every lab these days is like flow cytometry, where you basically detect like the absence of CD55 and a CD59. And one thing I'll go ahead and say that may show up more in step two than step one is that PNH is actually not an acquired it's not like a genetic disorder that's like transmitted from that 12 spring or whatever. No, the way it usually happens, it's almost always an acquired defect in that peak aging that ultimately causes the problems that are observed with PNH. And obviously, right, as I described in the podcast this morning, you treat PNH with eculizumab. It's a monoclonal antibody against C5. But remember, prior to giving a person eculizumab, you certainly want to vaccinate them against Neisseria, right? Because by giving eculizumab, you're pharmacologically inducing a terminal complement component deficiency, which in this case is C5, right? Because you're essentially blocking C5 by giving a eculizumab. And you're essentially taking that medication for the rest of your life. Eculizumab costs a ton of money. It's like, last I checked, it was about $440,000 a year. But if you're looking for more definitive treatment of PNH, you can actually do like a stem cell transplant, and that will essentially take care of the issue. So I think that's all I want to say about PNH. I really want to finish this podcast in under 30 minutes. That's like literally my target. Let's see. Is there any other disease I've really not talked about? Come on, Divine, think. Ooh, sickle cell. Sickle cell. Let's talk about sickle cell. I haven't really talked about sickle cell yet. It's a floridly high yield disease to know about for your USMLE Step 1 exam, right? So sickle cell disease, it's an autosomal recessive disease. And basically, it's a mutation in your beta globin gene chain, right? So you basically substitute a glutamic acid for valine, okay? When you have that substitution of glutamic acid for valine, then your red blood cells begin to assume sickle shapes. And when they assume those sickle shapes, they can begin to clog off blood vessels, and that can cause lots and lots and lots of problems, right? So for example, one problem that can happen is a person can have like dactylitis. In fact, that's one of the most common presentations in kids, right? So like dactylitis, where they have like vaso-occlusive episodes of like the blood vessels that feed their fingers, okay? So like painful bones, painful hands, painful fingers in a young kid, that's sickle cell disease until proven otherwise, okay? Dactylitis, that's one of the most common presentations. Another relatively common presentation of PNH, of sickle cell disease is something called acute chest syndrome, right? In fact, that's probably one of the most common causes of death in sickle cell patients that are adults, right? So adult sickle cell patients, one of the most common causes of death is acute chest crisis. And that essentially arises when you begin to occlude that happens when you begin to occlude like your pulmonary like arteries, right? So you begin to have, usually they will show you like a chest x-ray and you'll see like an ill-defined like infiltrate. Basically, if you see chest pain in a patient with a history of sickle cell disease, that's your diagnosis of acute chest syndrome. And remember that patients, right, that have sickle cell disease, especially kids, they are susceptible to sepsis with encapsulated organisms. In fact, the most common cause, this is very high yield to know for the USMLEs, the most common cause of sepsis in kids with sickle cell disease is strep pneumo. Okay, that is why kids with sickle cell disease, basically from when they are born to like the age of like 5 or 6, they tend to get penicillin like every day prophylactically, so that they don't get pneumococcal sepsis. And you may say, Divine, why do they get pneumococcal sepsis? The mechanism behind that is, remember, your spleen protects you against encapsulated bugs. So the thing that happens is that if you have a sickle cell disease, you essentially occlude blood vessels that feed the spleen, right? Like your splenic artery, and that can cause like an infarct of the spleen. So these people essentially have like an autosplenectomy in a sense. And when they have that autosplenectomy, they lose the ability to protect themselves against encapsulated organisms like strep pneumo, H. flu, and Neisseria. In fact, most patients with sickle cell disease auto-infarct their spleens by the age of like 3, 4, or 5. Okay, so those patients with sickle cell disease, very early in life, you absolutely positively want to vaccinate them against strep pneumo, H. flu, and Neisseria meningitis, okay, against those shin organisms, because they can get very severe sepsis and die. In fact, very high yield to know this, the most common cause of death in kids with sickle cell disease is infection, right? And I would suspect that it's very likely from strep pneumo, because strep pneumo is the most common cause of sepsis in patients with a history of a sickle cell disease. So, most common cause of death in kids with sickle cell disease infection, most common cause of death in adults with sickle cell disease is that acute chest syndrome. That's a very high yield thing you want to know for exams. And I mean, obviously, the way you diagnose sickle cell disease, as with pretty much every other hemoglobinopathy, is something known as hemoglobin electrophoresis, right? So remember that sickle cell disease is an autosomal recessive condition, right? So if you have like one bad allele, right, obviously you will have, if you do hemoglobin electrophoresis, you'll observe regular hemoglobin A, like 50 or 55%. Remember, regular hemoglobin A is like alpha 2, beta 2. And then you'll also observe like 40% hemoglobin S, where you have, where you have the bad beta globin, like the bad hemoglobin, right, that has the bad beta globin, right, that has that glutamic acid substituted for valine, okay, versus a person. So that's sickle cell trait, where you have like one bad allele, right? But if you have sickle cell disease, that's where you have like both bad alleles, and that basically, I mean, obviously you will not observe any hemoglobin A on hemoglobin electrophoresis. You'll just see hemoglobin S, but you will actually also see hemoglobin F, okay? You'll also see hemoglobin F. Remember, hemoglobin F is alpha 2, gamma 2. Does not depend on beta globin chains, okay? So it will increase proportionally in the setting of a sickle cell disease. In fact, that hemoglobin F sort of tells you why patients with sickle cell disease, they rarely, rarely, if ever, get problems in the first 6 months of life, because you have very high amounts of hemoglobin F at birth. So it sort of protects you against the many clinical findings that are observed in the setting of a sickle cell disease. Okay, now to sort of make another integration, also tells us about treatment, right? So like hydroxyurea is actually used in the treatment of sickle cell disease. Why? Because it actually increases the synthesis of hemoglobin F by an unknown mechanism. No one really knows why that's the case. So, is there any other thing I want to say about sickle cell disease? Again, I apologize for the ums and ahs. These are lectures given from, again, I have usually the way I set up these lectures, because some people have asked me, Divine, how do you come up with these lectures? I sort of decide on general topics I want to discuss, and then I just sort of talk about them in a free-flowing, freestyle kind of format. Okay, so yeah, I think that's all I'll say about sickle cell disease. I mean, it's autosomal recessive. I already mentioned that. You have the glutamic acid to valine substitution that causes the issues. Remember, don't forget hemoglobin C disease, right? Hemoglobin C disease is where you have like the glutamic acid that's substituted for lysine, right? And you can have some people that can be like compound heterozygotes where they have like hemoglobin S and hemoglobin C. Okay, those are classic things you probably want to know for an exam. In general, hemoglobin SC disease is not as bad as sickle cell disease, right? So it's like sickle cell disease, you have hemoglobin SS, that's the worst. There is hemoglobin C disease, although this is like super, 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 super rare, where you have like two bad copies of hemoglobin C, where essentially you have the glutamic acid to lysine substitution on your two beta globin genes, okay? And then you have hemoglobin SC disease, where you essentially have hemoglobin S and hemoglobin C, and then you can have like sickle cell trait, where you have hemoglobin A and hemoglobin S. So in order of which is the worst, right? So sickle cell disease is the worst. That's where you have SS. Hemoglobin C disease is the next worst. In order of decreasing severity, sickle cell disease, where you have SS, followed by hemoglobin C disease, where you have like your homozygous for like the bad hemoglobin C. And then hemoglobin SC disease. And then sickle cell traits. That's the order of badness, from most bad to least bad. Okay, in fact, for the most part, sickle cell trait is asymptomatic. Contrast that with sickle cell disease, that is definitely symptomatic. Okay, and remember, again, most common cause of sepsis in patients with sickle cell disease, think about strep pneumo. And then if you also see like osteomyelitis in a patient with a history of sickle cell disease, you probably want to think about salmonella under those circumstances. Okay, so that is all I think I am going to say with regards to sickle cell disease. And personally, I think I have discussed everything I want to mention in the context of HemOnc. HemOnc Farm, there are podcasts specifically for those. Just sort of look further on my website and you should be good to go. So I wish you all the best. And again, as I round up, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, 2, CK, 2CS, and Step 3 exams. I've tutored thousands of people for those exams, and many of them have gone on to do well. In fact, I've never had a person I tutored fail the USMLE exams. And many people I've tutored have gotten in the high 240s, 250s, 260s, 270s on those exams. And then I also tutor for the like med school shelf exams and the preclinical exams, right? So like the exams you take in your first 2 years of a med school. And then I've also been on the admissions committee of a top 3 med school. I have like 1 year experience with that. So I do actually prepare like ERAS applications for med students applying for residency, and AMCAS applications for college students applying for a med school. And then on the off chance that you have a relative that's taking organic chemistry, I do also tutor organic chemistry. And then I also tutor for the internal medicine in training exam and the internal medicine board exam, believe it or not. So have a wonderful rest of your day. Have a wonderful Sunday. I will see you in the next podcast. And I will see you at our anniversary. That's actually the 14th of this month. That'll be our 1 year anniversary. So have a wonderful day. God bless. See you next time. Thank you.